It seemed to me, said Bliss, that you were considering remaining with her and postponing the search for Earth. I do not like to probe your mind, even lightly, but I was concerned for you, and that temptation under which you labored seemed to leap out at me. Treviz said, You're quite right. Momentarily, at least, I felt the temptation. The minister is a remarkable woman, and I've never met anyone quite like her. Did you strengthen my resistance, Bliss? She said, I've told you many times I must not and will not tamper with your mind in any way, Treviz. You beat down the temptation, I imagine, through your strong sense of duty. No, I rather think not. He smiled wryly. Nothing so dramatic and noble. My resistance was strengthened for one thing by the fact that it was cold, and for another, by the sad thought that it wouldn't take many sessions with her to kill me. I could never keep up the pace. Pellerat said, Well, anyway, you are safely aboard. What are we going to do next? In the immediate future, we are going to move outward through the planetary system at a brisk pace until we are far enough from Comporion's sun to make a jump. Do you think we will be stopped or followed? No, I really think that the minister is anxious only that we go away as rapidly as possible and stay away, in order that the vengeance of he who punishes not fall upon the planet. In fact, yes, she believes the vengeance will surely fall on us. She is under the firm conviction that we will never return. This, I hasten to add, is not an estimate of my probable level of infidelity, which she has had no occasion to measure. She meant that Earth is so terrible a bearer of misfortune that anyone who seeks it must die in the process. Bliss said, How many have left Comporion in search of Earth that she can make such a statement? I doubt that any Comporellian has ever left on such a search. I told her that her fears were mere superstition. Are you sure you believe that, or have you let her shake you? I know her fears are the purest superstition in the form she expresses them, but they may be well-founded just the same. You mean radioactivity will kill us if we try to land on it. I don't believe that Earth is radioactive. What I do believe is that Earth protects itself. Remember that all reference to Earth in the library on Trantor has been removed. Remember that Gaia's marvelous memory, in which all the planet takes part, down to the rock strata of the surface and the molten metal at the core, stopped short of penetrating far enough back to tell us anything of Earth. Clearly, if Earth is powerful enough to do that, it might also be capable of adjusting minds in order to force belief in its radioactivity and thus preventing any search for it. Perhaps because Comporion is so close that it represents a particular danger to Earth, there is the further reinforcement of a curious blankness. Deniador, who is a skeptic and a scientist, is utterly convinced that there is no use searching for Earth. He says it cannot be found. And that is why the minister's superstition may be well-founded. If Earth is so intent on concealing itself, might it not kill us or distort us rather than allow us to find it? Bliss frowned and said, Gaia! Treviz said quickly, Don't say Gaia will protect us. Since Earth was able to remove Gaia's earliest memories, it is clear that in any conflict between the two, Earth will win. Bliss said coldly, How do you know that the memories were removed? It might be that it simply took time for Gaia to develop a planetary memory, and that we can now probe backward only to the time of the completion of that development. And if the memory was removed, how can you be sure that it was Earth that did it? Treviz said, I don't know. I merely advance my speculations. Pellerat put in rather timidly, "If Earth is so powerful and so intent on preserving its privacy, so to speak, of what use is our search? You seem to think Earth won't allow us to succeed and will kill us if that will be what it takes to keep us from succeeding. In that case, is there any sense in not abandoning this whole thing?" It might seem we ought to give up, I admit. But I have this powerful conviction that Earth exists, and I must and will find it. And Gaia tells me that when I have powerful convictions of this sort, I am always right. "But how can we survive the discovery, old chap?" "It may be," said Trevise with an effort at lightness, "that Earth, too, will recognize the value of my extraordinary rightness and will leave me to myself. But, and this is what I am finally getting at, I cannot be certain that you two will survive, and that is of concern to me. It always has been, but it is increasing now, and it seems to me that I ought to take you two back to Gaia and then proceed on my own. It is I, not you, who first decided I must search for Earth. It is I, not you, who see value in it. It is I, not you, who am driven. Let it be I, then, not you, who take the risk. Let me go on alone. Janoff?" Pelleret's long face seemed to grow longer as he buried his chin in his neck. "I won't deny I feel envious, Golan. But I'd be ashamed to abandon you. I would disown myself if I did so." "Bliss?"
"Gaia will not abandon you, Trevise, whatever you do. If Earth should prove dangerous, Gaia will protect you as far as it can. And in any case, in my role as Bliss, I will not abandon Pell. And if he clings to you, then I certainly cling to him."
Trevise said grimly, "Very well, then. I've given you your chance. We go on together."
"Together," said Bliss.
Pelleret smiled slightly and gripped Trevise's shoulder. "Together. Always."
Bliss said, "Look at that, Pell." She had been making use of the ship's telescope by hand, almost aimlessly, as a change from Pelleret's library of Earth legendry. Pelleret approached, placed an arm about her shoulders, and looked at the viewscreen. One of the gas giants of the Camporellian planetary system was in sight, magnified till it seemed the large body it really was. In color, it was a soft orange, streaked with paler stripes. Viewed from the planetary plane, and more distant from the sun than the ship itself was, it was almost a complete circle of light.
"Beautiful," said Pelleret.
"The central streak extends beyond the planet, Pell."
Pelleret furrowed his brow and said, "You know, Bliss, I believe it does."
"Do you suppose it's an optical illusion?"
Pelleret said, "I'm not sure, Bliss. I'm as much a space novice as you are. Golan." Trevise answered the call with a rather feeble, "What is it?" and entered the pilot room, looking a bit rumpled, as though he had just been napping on his bed with his clothes on, which was exactly what he had been doing. He said in a rather peevish way,
"Please, don't be handling the instruments."
"It's just the telescope," said Pelleret. "Look at that." Trevise did. "It's a gas giant, the one they call Gallia, according to the information I was given." "How can you tell it's that one just looking?" "For one thing," said Trevise, "at our distance from the sun, and because of the planetary sizes and orbital positions, which I've been studying and plotting our course, that's the only one you could magnify to that extent at this time. For another thing, there's the ring.
ring?" said Bliss, mystified. "All you can see is a thin, pale marking, because we're viewing it almost edge-on. We can zoom up out of the planetary plane and give you a better view. Would you like that?"
Pellaret said, "I don't want to make you have to recalculate positions and courses, Golan."
"Oh, well, the computer will do it for me with little trouble." He sat down at the computer as he spoke and placed his hands on the markings that received them. The computer, finally attuned to his mind, did the rest. The far star, free of fuel problems or of inertial sensations, accelerated rapidly. And once again, Trevise felt a surge of love for a computer and ship that responded in such a way to him, as though it was his thought that powered and directed it, as though it were a powerful and obedient extension of his will. It was no wonder the Foundation wanted it back. No wonder Comporeon had wanted it for itself. The only surprise was that the force of superstition had been strong enough to cause Comporeon to be willing to give it up. Properly armed, it could outrun or outfight any ship in the galaxy, or any combination of ships, provided only that it did not encounter another ship like itself. Of course, it was not properly armed. Mayor Brano, in assigning him the ship, had at least been cautious enough to leave it unarmed. Pellaret and Bliss watched intently as the planet Gallia slowly, slowly tipped toward them. The upper pole, whichever it was, became visible, with turbulence in a large circular region around it, while the lower pole retired behind the bulge of the sphere. At the upper end, the dark side of the planet invaded the sphere of orange light, and the beautiful circle became increasingly lopsided. What seemed more exciting was that the central pale streak was no longer straight, but had come to be curved, as were the other streaks to the north and south, but more noticeably so. Now the central streak extended beyond the edges of the planet very distinctly, and did so in a narrow loop on either side. There was no question of illusion. Its nature was apparent. It was a ring of matter looping about the planet and hidden on the far side. "That's enough to give you the idea, I think," said Trevise. "If we were to move over the planet, you would see the ring in its circular form, concentric about the planet, touching it nowhere. You'll probably see that it's not one ring either, but several concentric rings."
"I wouldn't have thought it possible," said Pellaret blankly. "What keeps it in space?"
"The same thing that keeps a satellite in space," said Trevise. "The rings consist of tiny particles, every one of which is orbiting the planet. The rings are so close to the planet that tidal effects prevent it from coalescing into a single body." Pellaret shook his head.
"It's horrifying when I think of it, old man. How is it possible that I can have spent my whole life as a scholar and yet know so little about astronomy?"
"And I know nothing at all about the myths of humanity. No one can encompass all of knowledge. The point is that these planetary rings aren't unusual. Almost every single gas giant has them, even if it's only a thin curve of dust. As it happens, the Sun of Terminus has no true gas giant in its planetary family, so unless a Terminian is a space traveler, or has taken university instruction in astronomy, he's likely to know nothing about planetary rings. What is unusual is a ring that is sufficiently broad to be bright and noticeable, like that one. It's beautiful. It must be a couple of 100 kilometers wide, at least." At this point, Pellaret snapped his fingers. "That's what it meant." Bliss looked startled.
"What is it, Pell?"
Pellaret said, "I came across a scrap of poetry once, very ancient, and in an archaic version of Galactic that was hard to make out, but that was good evidence of great age.
Though I shouldn't complain of the archaism, old chap, my work has made me an expert on various varieties of old galactic, which is quite gratifying, even if it is of no use to me whatever outside my work. What was I talking about? Bliss said, "An old scrap of poetry, Pell dear." "Thank you, Bliss," he said. And to Trevise, "She keeps close track of what I say in order to pull me back whenever I get off course, which is most of the time."
"It's part of your charm, Pell," said Bliss, smiling.
"Anyway, this scrap of poetry purported to describe the planetary system of which Earth was a part. Why it should do so, I don't know, for the poem as a whole does not survive. At least, I was never able to locate it. Only this one portion survived, perhaps because of its astronomical content. In any case, it spoke of the brilliant triple ring of the sixth planet, both braid and large, say the world shrunk in comparison. I can still quote it, you see. I didn't understand what a planet's ring could be. I remember thinking of three circles on one side of the planet, all in a row. It seemed so nonsensical, I didn't bother to include it in my library. I'm sorry now I didn't inquire." He shook his head. "Being a mythologist in today's galaxy is so solitary a job, one forgets the good of inquiring." Trevise said consolingly, "You were probably right to ignore it, Janoff. It's a mistake to take poetic chatter literally." "But that's what was meant," said Pellerat, pointing at the screen. "That's what the poem was speaking of. Three wide rings, concentric, wider than the planet itself." Trevise said, "I never heard of such a thing. I don't think rings can be that wide. Compared to the planet they circle, they are always very narrow." Pellerat said, "We never heard of a habitable planet with a giant satellite, either, or one with a radioactive crust. This is uniqueness number three. If we find a radioactive planet that might be otherwise habitable, with a giant satellite, and with another planet in the system that has a huge ring, there would be no doubt at all that we had encountered Earth." Trevise smiled. "I agree, Janoff. If we find all three, we will certainly have found Earth."
"If," said Bliss with a sigh.
They were beyond the main worlds of the planetary system, plunging outward between the positions of the two outermost planets, so that there was now no significant mass within 1.5 billion kilometers. Ahead lay only the vast cometary cloud, which, gravitationally, was insignificant. The far star had accelerated to a speed of 0.1 c, one-tenth the speed of light. Trevise knew well that, in theory, the ship could be accelerated to nearly the speed of light. But he also knew that, in practice, 0.1 c was the reasonable limit. At that speed, any object with appreciable mass could be avoided. But there was no way of dodging the innumerable dust particles in space, and, to a far greater extent even, individual atoms and molecules. At very fast speeds, even such small objects could do damage, scouring and scraping the ship's hull. At speeds near the speed of light, each atom smashing into the hull had the properties of a cosmic ray particle. Under that penetrating cosmic radiation, anyone on board ship would not long survive. The distant stars showed no perceptible motion in the viewscreen, and even though the ship was moving at 30,000 kilometers per second, there was every appearance of it standing still. The computer scanned space to great distances for any oncoming object of small but significant size that might be on a collision course,
and the ship veered gently to avoid it, in the extremely unlikely case that that would be necessary. Between the small size of any possible oncoming object, the speed with which it was passed, and the lack of inertial effect as the result of the course change, there was no way of telling whether anything ever took place in the nature of what might be termed a close call. Trevise, therefore, did not worry about such things, or even give it the most casual thought. He kept his full attention on the three sets of coordinates he had been given by Deniador, and particularly on the set which indicated the object closest to themselves. "Is there something wrong with the figures?" asked Pellerat anxiously. "I can't tell yet," said Trevise. "Coordinates in themselves aren't useful unless you know the zero point and the conventions used in setting them up, the direction in which to mark off the distance, so to speak, what the equivalent of a prime meridian is, and so on." "How do you find out such things?" said Pellerat blankly. "I obtained the coordinates of Terminus and a few other known points relative to Camporeon. If I put them into the computer, it will calculate what the conventions must be for such coordinates if Terminus and the other points are to be correctly located. I'm only trying to organize things in my mind so that I can properly program the computer for this. Once the conventions are determined, the figures we have for the Forbidden Worlds might possibly have meaning."
"Only possibly," said Bliss.
"Only possibly, I'm afraid," said Trevise. "These are old figures, after all, presumably Camporeon, but not definitely. What if they are based on other conventions?"
"In that case?"
"In that case, we have only meaningless figures. But we just have to find out." His hands flickered over the softly glowing keys of the computer, feeding it the necessary information. He then placed his hands on the hand marks on the desk. He waited while the computer worked out the conventions of the known coordinates, paused a moment, then interpreted the coordinates of the nearest forbidden world by the same conventions, and finally located those coordinates on the galactic map in its memory. A star field appeared on the screen and moved rapidly as it adjusted itself. When it reached stasis, it expanded, with stars bleeding off the edges in all directions, until they were almost gone. At no point could the eye follow the rapid change. It was all a speckled blur. Until finally, a space 1/10 of a parsec on each side, according to the index figures below the screen, was all that remained. There was no further change, and only half a dozen dim sparks relieved the darkness of the screen.
"Which one is the Forbidden World?" asked Pellerat softly.
"None of them," said Trevise. "Four of them are red dwarfs, one a near-red dwarf, and the last a white dwarf. None of them can possibly have a habitable world in orbit about them."
"How do you know they're red dwarfs just by looking at them?"
Trevise said, "We're not looking at real stars. We're looking at a section of the galactic map stored in the computer's memory. Each one is labeled. You can't see it, and ordinarily I couldn't see it either. But as long as my hands are making contact as they are, I am aware of a considerable amount of data on any star on which my eyes concentrate."
Pellerat said in a woebegone tone, "Then the coordinates are useless."
Trevise looked up at him. "No, Genoff, I'm not finished. There's still the matter of time. The coordinates for the Forbidden World are those of 20,000 years ago. In that time, both it and Camporeon have been revolving about the galactic center, and they may well be revolving at different speeds and in orbits of different inclinations and eccentricities. With time, therefore, the two worlds may be drifting closer together or farther apart, and in 20,000 years,
the forbidden world may have drifted anywhere from 0.5 to 5 parsecs off the mark. It certainly wouldn't be included in that 10th parsec square.
What do we do then?
We have the computer move the galaxy 20,000 years back in time relative to Comporeon.
Can it do that?
Asked Bliss, sounding rather awestruck.
Well, it can't move the galaxy itself back in time, but it can move the map and its memory banks back in time.
Bliss said,
Will we see anything happen?
Watch, said Trevise. Very slowly, the half-dozen stars crawled over the face of the screen. A new star, not hitherto on the screen, drifted in from the left-hand edge, and Pellerat pointed in excitement.
There! There!
Trevise said, Sorry, another red dwarf. They're very common. At least 3/4 of all the stars in the galaxy are red dwarfs. The screen settled down and stopped moving.
Well,
said Bliss. Trevise said, That's it. That's the view of that portion of the galaxy as it would have been 20,000 years ago. At the very center of the screen is a point where the forbidden world ought to be if it had been drifting at some average velocity.
Ought to be, but isn't,
said Bliss sharply. It isn't, agreed Trevise, with remarkably little emotion. Pellerat released his breath in a long sigh.
Oh, too bad, Golan.
Trevise said, Wait, don't despair. I wasn't expecting to see the star there.
You weren't,
said Pellerat, astonished.
No, I told you that this isn't the galaxy itself, but the computer's map of the galaxy. If a real star is not included in the map, we don't see it. If the planet is called Forbidden, and has been called so for 20,000 years, the chances are it wouldn't be included in the map. And it isn't, for we don't see it.
Bliss said,
We might not see it because it doesn't exist. The Comporelian legends may be false, or the coordinates may be wrong.
Very true. The computer, however, can now make an estimate as to what the coordinates ought to be at this time, now that it has located the spot where it may have been 20,000 years ago. Using the coordinates corrected for time, a correction I could only have made through use of the star map, we can now switch to the real star field of the galaxy itself.
Bliss said, But you only assumed an average velocity for the forbidden world. What if its velocity was not average? You would not now have the correct coordinates.
True enough. But a correction, assuming average velocity, is almost certain to be closer to its real position than if we had made no time correction at all.
You hope, said Bliss doubtfully.
That's exactly what I do, said Trevise. I hope. And now, let's look at the real galaxy. The two onlookers watched tensely while Trevise, perhaps to reduce his own tensions and delay the zero moment, spoke softly, almost as though he were lecturing.
It's more difficult to observe the real galaxy, he said. The map in the computer is an artificial construction, with irrelevancies capable of being eliminated. If there is a nebula obscuring the view, I can remove it. If the angle of view is inconvenient for what I have in mind, I can change the angle, and so on. The real galaxy, however, I must take as I find it. And if I want to change, I must move physically through space, which will take far more time than it would take to adjust a map. And as he spoke, the screen showed a star cloud so rich in individual stars as to seem an irregular heap of powder.
Trevise said, That's a large-angle view of a section of the Milky Way, and I want the foreground, of course. If I expand the foreground, the background will tend to fade in comparison.
The coordinate spot is close enough to Camporeon so that I should be able to expand it to about the situation I had on the view of the map. Just let me put in the necessary instructions, if I can hold on to my sanity long enough. Now. The starfield expanded with a rush, so that thousands of stars pushed off every edge, giving the watchers so real a sensation of moving toward the screen that all three automatically leaned backward as though in response to a forward rush. The old view returned, not quite as dark as it had been on the map, but with the half-dozen stars shown as they had been in the original view. And there, close to the center, was another star, shining far more brightly than the others. "There it is," said Pellerat in an awed whisper. "It may be. I'll have the computer take its spectrum and analyze it." There was a moderately long pause. Then Trevise said, "Spectral class G4, which makes it a trifle dimmer and smaller than Terminus's sun, but rather brighter than Camporeon's sun. And no G-class star should be omitted from the computer's galactic map. Since this one is, that is a strong indication that it may be the sun about which the Forbidden World revolves." Bliss said, "Is there any chance of its turning out that there is no habitable planet revolving about this star after all?" "There's a chance, I suppose. In that case, we'll try to find the other two Forbidden Worlds." Bliss persevered. "And if the other two are false alarms, too?" "Then we'll try something else."
"Like what?"
"I wish I knew," said Trevise grimly. Part 3. Aurora. Chapter 8. Forbidden World. 31.
"Golan," said Pellerat, "does it bother you if I watch?"
"Not at all, Janoff," said Trevise.
"If I ask questions?"
"Go ahead." Pellerat said, "What are you doing?" Trevise took his eyes off the viewscreen. "I've got to measure the distance of each star that seems to be near the Forbidden World on the screen so that I can determine how near they really are. Their gravitational fields must be known, and for that I need mass and distance. Without that knowledge, one can't be sure of a clean jump."
"How do you do that?"
"Well, each star I see has its coordinates in the computer's memory banks, and these can be converted into coordinates on the Camporeon system. That can, in turn, be slightly corrected for the actual position of the far star in space relative to Camporeon's sun, and that gives me the distance of each. Those red dwarfs all look quite near the Forbidden World on the screen, but some might be much closer and some much further. We need their three-dimensional position, you see." Pellerat nodded and said,
"And you already have the coordinates of the Forbidden World?"
"Yes, but that's not enough. I need the distances of the other stars to within a percent or so. Their gravitational intensity in the neighborhood of the Forbidden World is so small that a slight error makes no perceptible difference. The sun about which the Forbidden World revolves, or might revolve, possesses an enormously intense gravitational field in the neighborhood of the Forbidden World, and I must know its distance with perhaps 1,000 times the accuracy of that of the other stars. The coordinates alone won't do."
"Then what do you do?"
"I measure the apparent separation of the Forbidden World, or rather its star, from three nearby stars, which are so dim it takes considerable magnification to make them out at all. Presumably, those three are very far away. We then keep one of those three stars centered on the screen
and jump a tenth of a parsec in a direction at right angles to the line of vision to the forbidden world. We can do that safely enough, even without knowing distances to comparatively far-off stars. The reference star, which is centered, would still be centered after the jump. The two other dim stars, if all three are truly very distant, do not change their positions measurably. The forbidden world, however, is close enough to change its apparent position in parallactic shift. From the size of the shift, we can determine its distance. If I want to make doubly certain, I choose three other stars and try again. Pellerat said, "How long does all that take?" "Not very long. The computer does the heavy work. I just tell it what to do. What really takes the time is that I have to study the results and make sure they look right and that my instructions aren't at fault somehow. If I were one of those daredevils with utter faith in themselves and the computer, it could all be done in a few minutes." Pellerat said, "It's really astonishing. Think how much the computer does for us." "I think of it all the time." "What would you do without it?" "What would I do without a gravitic ship? What would I do without my astronautic training? What would I do without 20,000 years of hyperspatial technology behind me? The fact is that I'm myself, here, now. Suppose we were to imagine ourselves 20,000 additional years into the future. What technological marvels would we have to be grateful for? Or might it be that 20,000 years hence, humanity would not exist?"
"Scarcely that," said Pellerat. "Scarcely not exist. Even if we don't become part of Galaxia, we would still have psychohistory to guide us."
Trevise turned in his chair, releasing his handhold on the computer. "Let it work out distances," he said, "and let it check the matter a number of times. There's no hurry." He looked quizzically at Pellerat and said, "Psychohistory. You know, Genoff, twice that subject came up on Comporion, and twice it was described as a superstition. I said so once, and then Deniador said it also. After all, how can you define psychohistory but as a superstition of the Foundation? Isn't it a belief without proof or evidence? What do you think, Genoff? It's more your field than mine."
Pellerat said, "Why do you say there's no evidence, Golan? The simulacrum of Harry Seldon has appeared in the Time Vault many times and has discussed events as they happened. He could not have known what those events would be in his time had he not been able to predict them psychohistorically."
Trevise nodded. "That sounds impressive. He was wrong about the mule, but even allowing for that, it's impressive. Still, it has an uncomfortable, magical feel to it. Any conjurer can do tricks."
"No conjurer could predict centuries into the future."
"No conjurer could really do what he makes you think he does."
"Come, Golan. I can't think of any trick that would allow me to predict what will happen 5 centuries from now."
"Nor can you think of a trick that will allow a conjurer to read the contents of a message hidden in a pseudo-tesseract on an unmanned orbiting satellite. Just the same, I've seen a conjurer do it. Has it ever occurred to you that the time capsule, along with the Harry Seldom simulacrum, may be rigged by the government?"
Pellerat looked as though he were revolted by the suggestion. "They wouldn't do that."
Trevise made a scornful sound.
Pellerat said, "And they'd be caught if they tried."
"I'm not at all sure of that. The point is, though, that we don't know how psychohistory works at all."
"I don't know how that computer works, but I know it works."
"That's because others know how it works. How would it be if no one knew how it worked?
Then, if it stopped working for any reason, we could be helpless to do anything about it. And if psychohistory suddenly stopped working?
The second foundationers know the workings of psychohistory.
How do you know that, Janov?
So it is said.
Anything can be said.
Ah, we have the distance of the forbidden world star, and, I hope, very accurately. Let's consider the figures.
He stared at them for a long time, his lips moving occasionally, as though he were doing some rough calculations in his head. Finally, he said, without lifting his eyes, "What's Bliss doing?"
"Sleeping, old chap," said Pellerat. Then, defensively, "She needs sleep, Golan. Maintaining herself as part of Gaia across hyperspace is energy-consuming."
"I suppose so," said Treviz, and turned back to the computer. He placed his hands on the desk and muttered, "I'll let it go in several jumps and have it recheck each time." Then he withdrew them again and said, "I'm serious, Janov. What do you know about psychohistory?"
Pellerat looked taken aback. "Nothing. Being a historian, which I am after a fashion, is worlds different from being a psychohistorian. Of course, I know the two fundamental basics of psychohistory, but everyone knows that."
"Even I do. The first requirement is that the number of human beings involved must be large enough to make statistical treatment valid. But how large is large enough?"
Pellerat said, "The latest estimate of the galactic population is something like 10 quadrillion, and that's probably an underestimate. Surely that's large enough."
"How do you know?"
"Because psychohistory does work, Golan. No matter how you chop logic, it does work."
"And the second requirement," said Treviz, "is that human beings not be aware of psychohistory, so that the knowledge does not skew their reactions. But they are aware of psychohistory."
"Only of its bare existence, old chap. That's not what counts. The second requirement is that human beings not be aware of the predictions of psychohistory, and that they are not. Except that the second foundationers are supposed to be aware of them, but they are a special case."
"And upon those two requirements alone, the science of psychohistory has been developed. That's hard to believe."
"Not out of those two requirements alone," said Pellerat. "There are advanced mathematics and elaborate statistical methods. The story is, if you want tradition, that Harry Seldon devised psychohistory by modeling it upon the kinetic theory of gases. Each atom or molecule in a gas moves randomly, so that we can't know the position or velocity of any one of them. Nevertheless, using statistics, we can work out the rules governing their overall behavior with great precision. In the same way, Seldon intended to work out the overall behavior of human societies, even though the solutions would not apply to the behavior of individual human beings."
"Perhaps, but human beings aren't atoms."
"True," said Pellerat. "A human being has consciousness, and his behavior is sufficiently complicated to make it appear to be free will. How Seldon handled that, I haven't any idea.